The question was asked, when we look at Jewish history, we see situations like Maimonides, Rav Moshe Chaim Litzato. We see situations of rabbis who were later not only accepted, but incorporated as an integral part of the Jewish literature, the halacha, and yet in their day they weren't accepted, or at least they were challenged and sometimes banned. And how are we to understand that? So let's begin with an example of Maimonides, and then from that example we will, Be'ezrat Hashem, have a direction of thought which will help us in other instances. Okay, Maimonides is a great example, because in Maimonides' case, you had at least two camps that opposed him, and I would really say there were three. Let's begin with the easiest camp. Those who were jealous of him. Those who did not take the time to know who he was. Those who simply said, that young maverick, what does he know? Who does he think he is, writing a composition that's going to be instead of the Talmud, instead of all the oral law? Boy, we got to burn his books. So Maimonides, in a letter to his student, says, I beg you, don't argue with people and try to protect my honor. I knew when I wrote my composition that there would be people who come out against me and people who defame me, and people who will speak badly about me, even though they don't know me. And they didn't even bother reading my book. But it all stems from jealousy, and don't bother with them. So that's group number one. Okay? We don't have to deal with that. There are always people who aren't pious. There are always people who claim they're extra super pious. People think Korach were who knows what, you know? He had a tattoo of a skeleton saying, I'm Korach. No! Korach had a long white beard. And Korach was super pious. And Korach did every chumrah you could find in the book. And Korach gave the impressions of being the most super pious person. He was a Levite. So the fact that people can have ulterior motives and yet wear long white beards and say all kinds of things, that's nothing new. It's been the case from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. So I'm not dealing with that group. That shouldn't interest us too much. There are always people who have positions of power, positions of prestige, but really they don't live up to their name, and they're going to work out of incorrect interests, out of their partiality, out of their weaknesses, and I don't have to deal with those people, like Maimonides says. I leave them on the side. So that's group number one. And sometimes those people can lead a community. Sometimes those people can be the influential people who insist that Maimonides' work doesn't enter that community. The fact that people are impious, the fact that people are very biased and unfair, doesn't mean they won't get positions of leadership and control. Mekom ha-mishpat, shama ha-resha. Shlomo HaMelech already warned us that the higher up you go in the echelons of leadership, the more likely it is you'll find wickedness. So we'd like to think that in the Torah world that's not so, and it shouldn't be so, but we have no such guarantee. On the contrary, we have a warning that that could very easily be so. As the Torah warns us in Parshas Shoftim, that the Torah considers the judge someone who's supposed to be of the highest integrity and the highest Torah knowledge. And then the Torah comes and warns us, don't plant idols near my temple mount. What do the two have to do with one another? Our sages say that God places a special eye on those people who appoint the judges, and says, if you appoint judges that aren't worthy, I hold it against you, as though you planted idol worship on my temple mount. Because the judges are like the Temple Mount. They're like the plants on the Temple Mount. They're supposed to be representing God in the world. So you see, the Torah already addressed the problem that could come with judges who were wrong, with leaders who were wrong, people who were far from being pious but were taking positions of leadership in the name of piety. So that group number one, we're not dealing with. Okay? That's one type of person who defamed Maimonides. The reason I like the example of Maimonides is because there's a group number two and a group number three. The group number two being the rabbis, as you mentioned earlier, Rabbeinu Yonah, who spent a chunk of his life traveling through Europe and preaching that we should burn the books of Maimonides. So there, you have to deal with that. That's not jealousy. That's pious rabbis who came out against Maimonides. And those rabbis really divide into two classes. We'll deal primarily with the second group. What did the rabbis have against Maimonides?
Something that he didn't have sources to what he wrote.
Who says that?
Who says that?
Correct.
We talk about Rambam, right?
Correct.
Who says that?
Because Maimonides addresses in his letter...
The French.
I don't know. I can tell you from Maimonides' letters. What you're saying, what sources do you have for what you're saying?
David Ben Yehuda.
So I don't know.
From here.
You have to ask him where he's getting it from. I don't know.
I don't remember the names, but there was, in French, they wouldn't use Rambam. Because they say his work doesn't have
sources,
like he just writes a lot of stuff, but he doesn't say where he comes, where he has it from.
Maimonides himself says he made a mistake by doing that.
Yeah, but they wouldn't accept that.
Wouldn't accept and wouldn't use are two different questions.
They wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't use it. They wouldn't use anything of his work. There was a big rabbi from France who said that, and then a student of him. Okay, this is the story. And what happens that the Goyim burns a lot of Gemara, and at that time it was before they could print books, so it took many years to make it. And the student of this rabbi made some soul searching. And he comes to this conclusion that they are wrong, that his teacher was wrong. So he starts preaching that they should use Rambam and so on and so on. And he wanted to go to Israel. And then, I don't remember if it was Spain or something, they asked him to make a yeshiva. And he doesn't come in then to Israel. Spain.
Okay, so
I don't remember the names of those two rabbis in France. I think it's after Rambam is alive, the time after, like it wasn't like in the time where he was alive.
But it's interesting because the Rambam doesn't accept that claim against him. Rambam in a letter says, I know that people fault me that I didn't quote sources. And then he goes on to defend it. And he says, with all due respect, I don't see that as a valid claim against me. Meaning, it seems to me that the Rambam doesn't really accept that as a valid claim against him. But there were other claims against the Rambam. And those claims held weight for a long time, possibly even till today. And those were claims against Maimonides' philosophy, Maimonides' adoption of certain concepts from Greek philosophy, and those claims we find continued through the generations. They were not only in the Rambam's days, they were in Nachmanides' days and in Nachmanides' works. Nachmanides, who gives great weight to Maimonides and praises Maimonides and calls him the rabbi, still goes out against Maimonides' acceptance of certain concepts from Greek philosophy. And then Nachmanides' disciple, the Rashba, follows suit. And we find this approach going on and on. The Rashba writes very strong words against Maimonides' philosophical work. And this idea shows up again, even in Rav Moshe Isserle's work, the Ramah, the Darkei Moshe on the tour. We find that great rabbis, including the Ramah, whose opening passage in Shulchan Aruch is a quote from Mora Nebuchim, from the Guide to the Perplexed. The Ramah begins his work in Shulchan Aruch with a quote from Maimonides' philosophical work, and nonetheless, in more than one place in the Shulchan Aruch, he minces no words going out against Maimonides' philosophy when it adopts from the Greek philosophy. So you have a situation where the rabbis initially don't want to accept from Maimonides because he has taken philosophies which they hold to be foreign to Jewish thought, and he has adopted them, and he, Maimonides claims they are part of Jewish thought. And then later on, the rabbis will accept part of what he's done and not accept other parts, which holds true till today. There are concepts in Maimonides that the rabbis do not accept. They do not go with Maimonides' interpretation. So, you have Rabbeinu Yonah of the city of Gerudni, who goes throughout Europe preaching that they should burn Rambams. And then he himself witnesses how copies of Talmud are burnt on the same ashes as Maimonides was burnt. The same public squares that still had the ash of Maimonides' books being burnt publicly because Rabbeinu Yonah preached that they should were the same location where the Talmud was burned, where cartloads of Talmud were burned. And so Rabbeinu Yonah, when he sees that, reconsiders. And after much thought, decides that he was in error. And he starts his journey all over again through Europe, telling people publicly, I made a mistake. I was wrong in saying to burn the Rambam. And then he, in his own halachic work, goes on to quote the Rambam and give the Rambam halachic weight, and writes a whole book, Sha'arei Teshuvah, The Gates of Repentance, about how one is to repent in one's life. So, initially, the rabbis do not accept Rambam. Many rabbis do not accept him. They do not accept him to a large degree because of his philosophical work. And then later on, they reconsider and do accept him. The fact that Rambam is accepted is because the rabbis accepted him. If they wouldn't have accepted him, then he would not be accepted. The fact that Rabbeinu Yonah later on accepts him, the fact that Nachmanides gives him halachic weight, the fact that the Shulchan Aruch accepts him, that gives the Rambam the credence. Now, the fact that they came out against him about certain points, and the fact that initially they came out against him in a broader fashion, okay, I don't think that's such a big question. There is another point, and that's the third group of rabbis that came out against Rambam. And that is that the Rambam was a maverick. Imagine that this young scholar writes a work that is so innovative, nothing like it has ever been written. And he has the temerity to write in the introduction to his work that this book is going to replace all of the oral tradition. My book is so that you read Tanakh in my book. So Rambam meant it for the sake of heavens. He meant it in an obvious way for those that are not learned, so that they could learn Tanakh and Rambam. And he writes that in his introduction. He says, of course you have to learn Talmud. Of course you have to learn everything. But I know there are so many people who can't. So let them use my work. Just like today, we learn a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. So in the Rambam's day, if you were a simple person, you had to work. You couldn't learn the way you had to. You could only learn 6 to 8 hours a day. So then Rambam says, okay, you poor guy, you can't really learn. You're only learning 6 to 8 hours a day. So you'll learn Tanakh and you'll learn my work, and at least that way you'll know what to do in life. So the Rambam didn't mean any harm. But imagine that you're the Ra'avad, Rabbi Avram Av Beis Din. You're the chief rabbi. You're an old man with a white beard. You're in your 80s or 90s. You have hundreds of students. And they bring you in these manuscripts and they say there's a young rabbi who just put this out and says, instead of learning Talmud, this is what we should master. So what do? You sit down and you go over the work and you say, okay, he's a pretty smart fellow, but he's messed up in a few places. And so the Ra'avad, who was the old rabbi, when the Rambam came to the scene as a young rabbi, the Ra'avad writes his commentary on the Rambam for his students. He was the head of the yeshiva. And he writes it with total disrespect for the Rambam. Because who's the Rambam? The Ra'avad is the old rabbi and the Rambam's the young, up-and-coming rabbi. But he's young. So the Ra'avad writes it and here he says, oh, he messed up, he forgot this Gemara. And here he treats the Rambam like a child. But the truth is that there were decades between the two of them. The Ra'avad was the old accepted Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rambam was the young rabbi who was up and coming and writing. And that's the style the Ra'avad writes about the Rambam. He doesn't write as the way we see the Rambam. You know, when we approach it, we have the Rambam, and then we say, okay, there's also Ravid. But that's not the way it was set up then. So this idea was also true a century and a half ago. There was the Marsham of Brezhin. He was a tremendous genius, brilliant rabbi at a very young age. He wrote his work, Das Torah, and he was writing response all across Europe and came up with fascinating insights and fascinating leniencies. And there was an old rabbi who had a whole academy writing his halachic work, Badei HaShulchan. And when he wrote his work, he writes in his introduction the following sentence. If you see me quoting from the Marsham of Brezhin, don't make the mistake to think that I give him any credence. I only quote him to argue with him. I do not feel you should rely on that work. Woe to the one who wrote it, something along those lines. Why? Because he was the old rabbi with his academy, and he heard there's this young rabbi who's coming up with fantastic new thoughts and fantastic leniencies. And he said, how does a young rabbi have the temerity to do such a thing? Rabbi Avram Shapiro, of blessed memory, says the continuation of the story was that the Badei HaShulchan met the Marsham of Brezhin and came back and told his disciples, he is a genius. He is worthy of writing such leniencies. I take back what I wrote in my introduction. Remove it. But it was too late. The printers were printing. So the line against the Marsham Brezhin is still in the introduction. But the truth is that the one who wrote it went back on what he said. He himself said, had I known he was such a genius, I wouldn't have said that about him. He has the right to say what he's saying. So that's the third group of rabbis who went out against the Rambam. And later it was realized that the Rambam was the genius that he was and that he had the right to write the work which he did. And in fact, that work has saved us till today. From the Rambam till this century, you almost don't find anyone that dealt with the questions of building a temple and Trumos and Maestros in Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam dealt with the whole oral tradition. He did things that no one else did. And so the Rambam in his great genius gave the Jewish people a tremendous gift. But that doesn't mean that in his day he was appreciated or the work was appreciated. And the Rambam writes in a letter that he was prepared for this. He writes, he says, I knew this would happen when I wrote my work, but I also know that in the long run, this is what the Jewish people need. And so the Rambam's name in Jewish history remains the Rambam. But in his day, it took time to realize who he was and the value of what he had done. And again, we have issues from those that were just jealous to those that had issues with the format in which he wrote, to those that had issues with his position in philosophy, which again extends till today, through the Rama, through the Shulchan Aruch. Meaning, it's not like Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Moshe Isserles and the Shulchan Aruch accepted Maimonides' philosophy. On certain things, yes. As we said, that's the first quote in the Ramah from the Maimonides' work on philosophy. And in other places, no. So, the later generations were willing to say, we're going to take from him 95%, but there's the 5% or the 2% or maybe the 1%. It's probably even less than a percent that we're not going to take from the Ramah.
I just think it's funny because today